It is 8:31, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And we have with us live in the studio once again, none other than Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
very wordy this morning.
Yes.
Okay, this is going to be like pulling teeth. Let me go get, I need to go get some implements.
Okay. It's foggy out. It's,
it is.
You know, just sort of, and foggy in here, too, for that matter.
Because none of us took a shower this morning.
Yeah, well, yes,
we were talking about multitudes.
Yes, we were talking about that earlier, actually, and also about Maria's former boyfriends.
May they
rest in peace. Anyway.
Well,
moving right along to affairs of the world.
Let's do that. Today is potentially a big day for the citizens of Iraq, because Iraq is, of course, supposed to produce a report.
It's an exciting day because the citizens of Iraq have really been looking forward to this for months. The United Nations has demanded, upon threat of instituting a comprehensive bombing campaign and regime change, that the United States produce a full list of all weapons that the Pentagon owns. And, as a taxpayer in this country, I don't really care about what weapons Iraq has. They're halfway around the world. There's no way they can get over here. Nobody, including our own CIA, thinks that they could possibly be a threat. And, there have been systematic campaigns to disarm that country for the past 12 years that have been probably the most effective of any such campaign in the history of the world. I want to know what weapons we have. The Pentagon in our country, routinely misplaces billions of dollars. We have an economic policy in this country, which we'll talk about in a minute, of, shoveling money toward the Pentagon and money that is provided by mostly the middle and upper middle and lower middle and poor, because we can't possibly tax the rich. And we have no idea what the Pentagon is doing with our money. We need a weapons list in this country. And, if we can't produce a weapons list in this country in 3 weeks, then I don't see how on earth we could possibly expect Iraq to.
Yeah, especially since we don't allow things like paper or pencils over there.
Yeah, because of course they're dual use. They could also be used. You could grind up the pencils and take the graphite lead out of them and use that lead to encase the wooden hand grenades that they're trying to build. I mean, it's just really preposterous. But it's been very interesting that virtually every day this week, not only has George Bush been saying, we think Iraq is not in compliance. We have evidence that they have weapons of mass destruction. Of course, they won't release any of that evidence because it does not exist, and because nobody thinks that it exists. But it's been very interesting that all of the TV networks and both of the daily papers, certainly in this city as well as in many other cities, have led with that every day of the week, like it's some kind of news, like this is something different that isn't being said every day of the week, and that there's any truth to it. Now, it's one thing to say that something is news because the President of the United States, who, let's face it, unfortunately is a very powerful man, is saying something. It's another thing entirely to report it as though it has any shred of truth to it. And, if it doesn't, then you have to have some sort of a journalistic effort to put that quote in context, or to balance it with opposing quotes, as, is invariably done when any kind of critic of administration policy is speaking. So, we really have been subjected this past week to a pretty strenuous propaganda campaign, within our own country. And that campaign has been building up very much toward the release of this report today by the Iraqi government. And there has been, no effort whatsoever to put in context, number one, just how preposterous the idea of the Iraqi government, or any government producing a full list of, what probably the biggest ministry in any country's government you know, has every, you know, right down to every paperclip.
Not just the government, but also commercial interests in Iraq.
Yes, very much
so. Think about that.
Yeah.
How, would the U.S. be able to put down in a list, in a 10,000-page document that can fill, you know, two file boxes?
Well, actually, it'd be longer than that.
That's what they've actually given to the UN is a 10,000-page document, which fills a couple of file boxes.
Yeah, but
at least
saying for the U.S. it'd be much longer.
Yeah, for the U.S. it would be much longer. All of the possible dual use chemicals and biological agents and possible weapons material in the U.S. not just used by the U.S. military and the Pentagon,
but any
company with an office in the U.S.
I mean, you would, not even necessarily just American companies, but any company that is in the United States. You would literally have to have a 10,000-page document just to list the companies, you know, let alone what they have. And, you know, and they're supposed to produce this list in, what, 3 weeks. So, number one, you have the requirement, which is preposterous. You have the fact that, you know, to every outside observer so far, and that's not necessarily to say that there are things that haven't been forthcoming, because it's impossible to prove a negative, but to every outside observer so far, the Iraqi government, given what it has to work with in terms of resources, has actually made a pretty remarkable effort to comply with unreasonable demands. That's number two. And then number three, you have the United States alone among, of any agency anywhere in the world saying, A, that they're not being compliant, B, that they're lying, and C, that we have evidence that they're lying. Nobody else is saying this anywhere. And then D, you have the U.S. media going along with this and not even balancing it with any quotes from any of the, or saying that nobody else agrees with them, or even that anybody else disagrees with them.
Or even pointing out very much that Hans Blix, the guy who's the head of the UN current UN weapons inspection team, has turned around and asked the U.S., well, okay, if you have this information on weapons that Iraq has, why don't you give it to us so we can go look for them?
Yeah.
And, of course, the U.S. has refused.
Yeah, and Blix himself, who remember, is basically the United States handpicked guy. I mean, they had, you know, it's not like there's a long list of people around the world who are experienced in these types of weapons inspections under these types of conditions. But the United States cast long and hard to find a guy who they thought would be sufficiently tough and would be sufficiently skeptical of Iraqi government claims and sufficiently sympathetic to what Washington wanted out of the process, which was, you know, much more than just looking for weapons. So this is Bush's guy. This is Washington's guy. And yet he has been around and been quoted in the public record as saying, you know, so far so good.
And that has not
been highlighted.
They've been visiting many of the sites listed in the U.S. report that Bush released earlier this year that was supposed to be proof that Iraq is building weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah,
and so far they found nothing in these places that were listed as the sites in the U.S. report.
Yeah.
And that has not been covered.
We're just jumping all over each because it's so outrageous.
Fine. I know.
But, you know, bear in mind, we talked about this on this program before, that many of the sites listed in that report were based on information that was years
old,
or even pre-Gulf War, even 12 or 13 years old during the Iraq-Iran conflict. But, you know, we're not getting that in the United States media either. Number one, we didn't get at the time that this was old information, which was all in the public record. And we're not getting now that those sites are being searched and then nothing's been found. It's not a surprise that nothing's been found there. It is something of a surprise that the Iraqi government has been so cooperative. But at the same time, you know, none of this is being put in the overall context of saying that the United States has absolutely no pretext that anybody else is aware of for launching any kind of an invasion of the country of Iraq. And yet those preparations are proceeding apace. And one of the arms of that preparation is that you and I and everybody listening to this program is also being prepared, because we're being fed a bunch of BS on a pretty much daily basis by our television and newspaper journalists, quote unquote.
Mm. It's leaving a lousy taste in my mouth.
Yeah, and a good morning to you, too. Speaking of a foggy morning.
All right, anything else on that?
No.
That's enough for starters.
All right. Well, moving along, looks like a lot of people in the White House are getting cash bonuses, except for Paul O'Neill.
Yeah, I love Friday mornings. I tell you, because I start to prepare for the radio show during the week, and I read what I think is going to be important, and then Friday morning rolls around, and I wake up to the news, and I hear that Bush has made another sort of pre-weekend announcement, trying to sneak it in before the newspapers can really start commenting on it. And it's always something that we want to talk about
the
show.
The idea being that most newspapers don't have large news staffs on Saturday and Sunday, so by Monday, you know, whatever
it's
was outrageous
news
that they're trying to bury,
becomes
old news.
Yeah.
And this has been a very, very common practice over the past 2 years, and let's face it, there's been a lot of bad news that they want to try and cover up.
This Friday, it was Bush firing his economic team, largely. He sacked Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and his senior economic advisor, Lawrence Lindsay. Both got booted out. There's been a lot of speculation in the business press that he would fire one or the other, but not both. But here it is. He's just gotten rid of both of them. It's a largely cosmetic change. These guys, in spite of what you might read in, like, the New York Times or other places, these guys haven't been fighting with Bush over very much. Basically, they've been implementing the Bush policy of massive tax cuts to stimulate the economy, and those massive tax cuts haven't done anything.
Yeah,
so
tax cuts very, very much weighted toward the top 1% or so of the economy.
Exactly, yeah. And massive tax cuts can't stimulate the economy. savings from tax cuts don't get spent on consumer goods, for example, which would boost the economy. They actually go towards savings, or they generally go to pay off debt, and that's not going to help much. So his economic policy has been garbage, but it's not going to be changing in the future with the ouster of these two guys. Basically, Bush is going to pursue more of that in the coming months, and the economy isn't going to recover. But he's making this cosmetic change in an effort to try and boost, for example, the stock market, hoping that if there's a new guy in the Treasury Secretary Department, it will make a difference for investor confidence rather than, say, consumer confidence or some such thing. But there were other problems with Paul O'Neill. It's not just that he had cosmetic problems. Basically, the Treasury Secretary, his job is international finance. He's the guy who basically has the reins on the IMF. And Paul O'Neill has made some disastrous missteps, particularly in Latin America when the Argentine crisis occurred. He was not quick enough in there to say, we need to bail you out or we need to find a solution here, and he basically let them default on their debt. That's dragged down all of Latin America, including Brazil, which is the major engine for that region of the world. And that
in turn helped get a sort of lefty guy named Lula elected president, which the Bush administration is appalled by.
And that's happening in other South American countries, too. And now the whole Bush administration is looking at South America and seeing the door close to U.S. business. And that's probably got them pretty scared. So it's past due for them to replace Paul O'Neill with somebody who knows what he's doing in that job. So that's one of the big reasons that you're not going to read about in the U.S. press for why they're replacing Paul O'Neill.
Yeah, South America is particularly critical, and we also had this week in Venezuela business sector led strikes, which are widely seen as part of the anti-Chavez and Bush administration efforts once again to undermine and possibly unseat Hugo Chavez. And in that country, we've seen increasing U.S. military involvement in Colombia, and the anti-American sentiment in South America is very widespread. And O'Neill was a famous and notorious figure in South America. He routinely misspoke also, and it's very interesting that Bush in his statements yesterday was talking about, you know, I'm not going to change any of my policies. This is about communicating our policies better. Well, you know, you can communicate your policies all they want. If they're fundamentally flawed policies, it's not going to help the economy. But this is all about the election in 2004. This is about Bush wanting to make the case that the economy is better and to try and improve the economy, at least for the people people who he thinks will cough up checks to the Republicans or Democrats. In 2004, he knows perfectly well that the platitudes that were being mouthed before the midterm elections of the economy is on track, recovery is just around the corner. I mean, we were having these statements trotted out every few days, and you know, there was never particularly any evidence for them. Any little uptick would be taken as a good sign, while the three or four simultaneous downticks were just, you know, ignored. And so, you know, we're 2 years into a recession now, which was not of Bush's making particularly, but certainly which he has helped exacerbate. And it's not going to get better, but the Bush administration is clearly worried at least about appearances, and this is all about appearances.
All right. Anything else on that?
That's enough on that. Let's move on.
Okay. Well, if you're looking at the papers, where I tend to get more of my information than from the TV, they're talking potentially about an income tax in our future here in Washington State.
Yes, that's right. You know, the 2001 legislature, Washington State Legislature, commissioned a tax study, and that the results from that tax study committee were due to be presented to the legislature by November 30th of this year. And sure enough, the Washington State Tax Structure Study Committee, it's a long name, chaired by Bill Gates' dad, William H. Gates Sr., produced a report that said that the state of Washington, in order to make their tax system more fair and more stable, needs a state income tax. And they were particularly, people have particularly in the press and politicians have picked up on the state individual income tax, although for you know, people like you and me. But they also studied variations on the corporate tax structure as well. They studied a value-added tax, which would significantly decrease business taxes. And they studied also a corporate income tax, which would also significantly decrease business taxes as well. That hasn't gotten much press, and it should, because the legislature may actually try to adopt one or the other of those policies, and that would shift the tax burden from businesses in the state of Washington, who, by the way, are not complaining that they are excessively taxed. In fact, most businesses, particularly small businesses, feel that they're not being taxed too much by the state. They have other concerns with their federal taxes and with local taxes, but I'm not hearing a huge groundswell from businesses that they want to have their taxes cut, although businesses like tax cuts whenever they can get it. But this would shift with a state income tax for individuals would shift, and a corporate income tax for businesses would shift a lot of the tax burden from businesses to individuals. Another thing about this Washington State tax study is that they studied variations on the state income tax, including a flat tax, which is used by about 8 different states around the U.S., and a progressive tax, which is much more fair and equitable. It's used by many, many states around the U.S., but the committee itself favored a flat tax. And that's, I find that kind of interesting, because there's an inherent bias in the way they study the flat tax versus the progressive tax. The flat tax would be based on adjusted gross income, which is your income before any deductions. And that means the flat tax would collect a lot and would be very stable, and it'd be easy to predict, and the state would be able to keep its track, its have its income go up when the incomes of all of its residents go up, and its income would go down when all of the residents in the state of Washington, for example, become unemployed or their income goes down. And that would make it much more stable and much easier to do the budget process. The progressive tax, on the other hand, the much more fair tax, which would shift the tax burden upwards to the rich, would be levied on federal taxable income, which is your income minus all of your deductions and exemptions. Now, people's deductions and exemptions vary from year to year. So the progressive tax would be more volatile. In other words, it would be harder to predict, and it wouldn't necessarily track people's income as well. When residents of the state of Washington have their incomes increase, then if they were paying a progressive tax to the state, that tax wouldn't necessarily increase in step. And when your income decreases, the state of Washington's income wouldn't necessarily decrease in step. So my question is, how come they didn't study a progressive tax on adjusted gross income? I think there's an inherent bias there. I think the tax commission is attempting to make a progressive tax look worse than it really is, so that we'll opt for a flat tax, which would be a little bit better than a sales tax, but still wouldn't shift the burden much to the rich in the state of Washington. I think that's really bad.
Yeah, you have to look really at who's on this commission. And, you know, William Gates Sr. is not just Bill Gates' dad. He's a senior partner in Preston Gates Ellis, hence the name Preston Gates Ellis, which is one of the most prestigious law firms, not just in Washington State, but in the country. It's where Slade Gordon went to work after he left the Senate. And that's not because it was his hometown law office. It's because it's a big, big player nationally as well. It's one of Boeing's major law firms. It's the law firm that made the whole sweatshop scam in the Northern Marianas Islands possible. It's not a law firm that has a track record of looking out for the little guy. And, you know, you can look at the other members of this commission, and with very few exceptions, none of them are either. They're all people who are studying tax structure from the standpoint of, is it good for government and is it good for big business? There's very few people looking out for small independent business owners, and there's certainly very few people looking out for poor and middle classes.
In spite of the rhetoric of the report, which says that they're trying to find a more fair and equitable system because the sales tax weighs more heavily on poor people.
Yeah, which is true. It does weigh more heavily on more poor people. And, you know, when we talk about income tax, you have to bear in mind that this is intended to be revenue neutral, that any kind of an income tax would also be part of a package that lowered property taxes and sales taxes. So it's not just a new tax on top of it. And it was also very interesting. I had a long interview with Tim Iman a couple of months ago, most of which didn't get published. And one of the questions I asked him that didn't get published was, you know, well, if you're talking about how unfair our tax system is to taxpayers, would you support a progressive income tax? And he goes, well, you know, I'm not going to answer that question because it's hypothetical. It'll never get passed politically in the state of Washington. And he's actually right, although, frankly, Iman's own works is making it more possible than it would otherwise ever be because you know, the state coffers become so desperately short of money that they're willing to consider things they otherwise wouldn't. But, you know, the medicine that the Gates Commission was using to make this go down is essentially the payoff to big business. And the assumption is that if it's a good package for large businesses, if it's a good package for government revenue forecasters, then it can be sold to the public. And it is true that we have
that's what they hope.
And, you know, we have an extremely regressive and extremely unfair tax structure in this state, and it is useful that this discussion is being opened up by that commission. But as Maria was saying, it's, you know, those aren't the only options that should be on the table, and they're certainly not the best options that could be considered for the state of Washington.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I have to wait to see what the legislature does as far as changing the tax structure before I start to criticize them. But I think that they wouldn't understand the difference between the two packages that were studied by the tax commission, and they would just simply opt for the flat tax without even looking at the progressive tax. That's my fear, and I hope they don't do that.
Yeah, and also because the flat tax has a certain resonance among conservatives, who are likely to be the strongest critic of the very concept of an income tax, not because of anything more than the fact that they hear the word tax and they go ballistic.
Yeah, and it's easy to understand and it's easy to calculate. So
yeah.
All right, well, we have just about 5 minutes left and a couple more things to cover. One of them was an interesting study came out this week.
Another interesting study. The Pew Charitable Trust did a global attitudes project. It's called What the World Thinks in 2002. And evidently, the U.S. press thinks that the world is only thinking about the United States because that's all they reported on in the study. But what they did report on was interesting because it's actually not a surprise that the majority of Muslim countries have a majority of people who have negative attitudes towards the United States.
Very negative.
Figure, yeah, 75% in Jordan, which is an ally. In another ally, Egypt, it's 69%. In Lebanon, another old ally of the U.S., it's 59%. And significantly, they couldn't do the poll in Saudi Arabia because they just weren't allowed. So we don't know how many people in Saudi Arabia have a negative attitude towards the United States. They also found it very high in Latin America. No surprise. We were just talking about why earlier. So, but another interesting finding was that they found 54% of Canadians, 67% of Germans, and 71% of French people are very uncomfortable with the spread of U.S. ideas and customs.
Yeah.
So,
and it was very interesting that many of those attitudes have shifted quite a bit over the past 2 years. And that's not all due to Bush administration foreign policies. A lot of it also is due to the spread of U.S. culture, the spread of corporate power around the world, many of those corporations being U.S.-based as well. And, you know, people miss that part of the American empire and sort of American imperialism that much of what is resented in a lot of part of the world is cultural as well. That pop culture is very popular in some for some people and very unpopular for a lot of others.
All right, real quickly, there was a student walkout and demo on Thursday, and I'm wondering if you can segue with some of the events coming up.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I wrote about it for the upcoming week, Seattle Weekly, so I won't talk about it here, but the students from all over our high schools around the city walked out, and about 500 of them marched downtown on Thursday, and it was a wonderful, wonderful event. Actually, much more positive and hopeful, actually, I thought, than many of the adult peace rallies that I've seen this past season. I want to put in a plug in memoriam also for Phil Berrigan, who passed away yesterday. I actually wrote a column on Thursday because I'm a friend of the family. I knew he was dying. I've known him for many years.
He's a longtime activist.
I have a column up on workingforchange.com that I wrote on Thursday. It's not, I wrote another one on Friday, so you have to go into the archives to find it. But he will very much be missed, and his spirit will very much live on. And to carry on the spirit of Phil and to uphold the spirit of our many high school students who walked out, there is an event tomorrow at Garfield for people who want to stop this insane war in Iraq that we've also been talking about. It is not simply another peace rally. It is the get in and volunteer and take on work and make organizing so that there is a massive opposition to this war happen. It is sort of a combination of rally and volunteer sign up and plug in and what you can do type event. It's happening at Garfield from, I believe, 10 till...
No, it's from...
No,
I think
noon.
From
noon.
Noon. I had 1 to 4:30.
I was thinking 1 too. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I had it down as noon.
Garfield High School, which is at 423rd Avenue.
Yeah, 23rd and Jefferson.
Noon is when the press needs to show up.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I can feel like I got two events going on at once tomorrow. But everybody should be there. It's it'll be a very good event, and they're hoping literally for a couple thousand people to come and sign up and start walking neighborhoods and doing outreach and starting organizing.
And with that, I want to mention a few of the peace vigils going on around town.
Yes.
Because the peace movement has been becoming very much more visible, and that's a good thing. We've got both newspapers having done articles recently, just in the past day or two, on the peace movement. Very positive articles, and it's because of this. There's a peace vigil on Saturdays from 4 to 5 p.m. to stop the war on Iraq. It's at Westlake Mall. It's the 911 Peace Coalition sponsors it. Also on Saturdays, there have been vigils at the post office in North Bend from 3 to 4 p.m. On Sundays from 2 to 3 p.m., there's a peace vigil at Green Lake at 63rd and East Green Lake Way North. Bring your own signs. On Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., there's a continuing peace vigil going on in Ballard at 22nd and Northwest Market Street. Bring your signs, bring your attitude. And on Thursdays from 5 to 6 p.m. at Westlake is the Women in Black vigil. Women wear black and stand silently holding signs to protest against war with Iraq and in Afghanistan. And men may come and leaflet and talk to the public.
And if you missed any of those, they're on Gene Buskin's Peace Calendar. The website is www.scn.org/activism/calendar.
All right.
And if you can't come 1 week, come the next.
With that, we are out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State, and very quickly tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Free paper comes out every couple of weeks, done by volunteers. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and places where you get your recycled trees. You can also find it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you'd like to subscribe, give gift subscriptions. We can always use those and donations as well, or volunteer, or have story tips, whatever. Give us a call. Our phone number, voicemail, area code 206-903-9461.